No, I really think that Mark Bruce has given us more than enough to talk about without my appearing and saying more. I was very fascinated by the presentation, and that I suppose knowing where to start as a very brief response. I was going to talk about some Old Testament uses of language, which is very, very fascinating. How the language of the religious world that they knew and encountered from round about could be transformed, if you like, in terms of it, to become a language of God. How the language of, worlds that one would assume to be very far from a biblical world is nevertheless present in the Psalter, and raises very, very fascinating questions. My favourite example is the very down-to-earth one of mountains in Jerusalem, which of course there are no mountains in Jerusalem, and yet the Psalter spoke of mountains in Jerusalem, how Mount Safon and so on. So mountains could be spoken of, although there were no mountains. There are hills in Jerusalem, but certainly not. So when one reaches, I think, that level, the ability to use language in that way, then I think it goes beyond questions of literal and non-literal. Because clearly the Psalter's language was referential. When one simply dismisses things as metaphorical or whatever, that is most unwise, especially in the light, I think, of the way people study metaphor today. And that it seems that they were indeed trying to find a language for their spiritual experience. Of course, there were no mountains, but to ascend to the temple was the spiritual equivalent of climbing a very great mountain. What they meant by light metaphors, which were very frequent in the ancient world, I suppose we really cannot know, but that undoubtedly one wouldn't dismiss it as ornamental, but clearly something was seen. And very, very fascinating as to how to express that, how to express an experience of God. Personally, I've always been very grateful for the apophatic tradition, and I've always been very grateful for that element in rabbinic Judaism which is reticent. The notion of reticence of God, in a sense, this goes back to my early experience as a teenager in synagogue, when I had what turned out to be a not unusual crisis of faith. But the thing is, when you're having it, and when you're only about 17 or 18, and when the world views you as religious, it is very difficult, and you don't realise that this is almost the stage in one's spiritual development. But why I had that, and what I could not accept, was precisely the apparent familiarity of God that my local synagogue seemed to bespeak, that people spoke of God with such familiarity and were so aware of God, apparently, in their language. And the question that constantly troubled me was, could whatever they are speaking of have created the universe? The universe as we know it today, I mean, not the universe as we knew it in medieval times. And I think my faith was gradually restored when I became more acquainted with reticence, with precisely perhaps the reticence that is responsible for Deuteronomic reservations about images. One does not deny the presence of images, although sometimes the Targums do. But one is concerned that the images will be confused with a reality that is infinitely beyond all of our prospective cognizance. And it therefore does not surprise me at all that there are trends in our tradition that seek to diminish our familiarity. Because precisely if one can go very far astray, there is in our esoteric tradition an Aramaic saying, which is Almo Barozo Kaimo, which is from the Zohar, that the world survives only in its sense of the mysterious, mm-hmm. that is the secret, literally, that lies beyond us. And so I suppose my approach to this is rather different. The idea that God might be encapsulated in some visible form for me is precisely not what I would seek in my life. There is the reverence, the silence, the tradition that language can only be a very approximate and very limited. The idea that things being confined to, that one could actually describe God or claim that, well, I've seen God, so now I know, would be for me very frightening indeed and terribly mistaken. So I recall actually being moved on a visit to an Orthodox monastery that I made when I was working in Jewish-Christian relations. I had the great privilege of talking to a sister who was also a maker of icons. And she was explaining to me that she never portrays God the Father. She alludes to at a corner of the icon, but Michelangelo type portrayals are not on the iconographic tray. And I was immensely grateful for that. I thought it was very much of the tradition that I had seen. And it is this sense of reticence, rather than iconoclasm, perhaps, that one can find in, that I find in the world of the Deuteronomists, as opposed to, and which for me is enormously important, and that the different images and visions in the Old Testament sort of coexist and speak to each other. I think they do in the Targums as well. They do in all of these senses of. The Targum is reluctant, or sometimes, not always. The Targums are far more complex than they are given credit for. But I think notions of presence, as opposed to speaking directly of God, are all of bound up with reticence. It was this reticence that also fascinated me when I wrote a small and slightly pretentious article. When I was comparing the rabbinic statements about Moses, how rabbis understood Moses, a very exalted figure of Moses, with how Philo understood Moses, which was remarkable, and which caused great annoyance when I once tried to explain to people what he meant by the Deuteros Theos, which I think you referred to as well, which was Moses. It was very, very extraordinary. And very exalted notions of Moses in the Samaritan literature, which were clearly touched, I think, by John's Gospel, and by the most exalted forms. And the rabbinic Moses, who never quite attains that level, who always remains human, even if there's only a slight distance between Moses and the ultimate. It was very, very fascinating. The rabbis would not go near the notion of a Deuteros Theos, of Moses somehow being a deputy, the word Theos being used, although Philo did not mean by that that Moses was God. But the problem is we only have one word for God, and my audience, and one member of it in particular, thought that was exactly what I was saying, and she was deeply alarmed by it. But it is the sort of the notion of reticence upon which our whole understanding of God, for me at least, would be that seems to me to come into play when one is talking about seeing God, and when one is talking about various textual emendations, which I also find very, very, very fascinating. If people were drawing back from something that would give undue familiarity and with where they would lose everything, ultimately. Now, so that was one strand of thought, and I'll sort of proceed very briefly in this, but I slightly mischievously would quote what would really be is obviously a very Jewish comment on the commentary on the experience of the burning bush, Moses at the burning bush, and his varying experiences of God. Now, this is as it was understood by a 12th century rabbinic figure whose name was Bathia ibn Pakuda, and who was rather less extreme in these matters than, of course, Maimonides, who was famously deuteronomic with a vengeance, if you like. Bachia wasn't, but still there is a difference between, I think, your approach, which is a deeply Christian approach touched by Christ, and Bachia's approach, which was a deeply Jewish approach, but also a very Islamic approach, which was touched very deeply by... He was... Quite clearly, the latest work on him shows how deeply he was involved with Sufi spirituality. But he writes this, and he says that his reading of the burning bush story is that the narrative underlines that Moses achieved the perception of three things. Firstly, the fire. Secondly, an angel. And thirdly, the divine presence. First he saw the fire take hold of the bush, which was not consumed, and he imagined it was an earthly fire, and therefore wanted to come closer. I must turn aside to see this great sight. Let me view this at close quarters to know what is happening. Had he imagined it was a heavenly fire, he would not have approached at all. After he saw the fire, his perception of the angel grew stronger. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame in the midst of the bush, and he perceived a vesture of fire, but then he perceived a being within it. And then, as happens in fact several times, according to various of our more esoteric commentators, the angel was rather more than an angel. The angel was in fact the manifestation of the presence of God. And so Moses has made this progress from the fire, the earthly fire, to the presence of God, and that so he experiences the glory, essentially the glory of the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah is another word for presence, which is very when the Bible says I will dwell in your midst, the word is v'shachanti, the Shekhinah is used, and that. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God then called to him out of the midst of the bush. And since this was Moses' first experience of prophecy, the Almighty wished gradually to initiate him and to raise him by stages until his spiritual perceptions were strengthened. And so even an encounter with the glory, if you like, was only one stage of a journey to that which would be ultimately indescribable and might be expressed only by a voice, perhaps, which is a different, mm-hmm. quite obviously. And no doubt if I was speaking out of a Christian vision, I would not quote this, but from a Jewish vision, one does. And one sees perhaps where he is coming from, that God gives us different perceptions of the divine, because it depends on who we are, and where we are, but that the sort of the physical image, even the anthropos, is deemed not the greatest of attainments, but almost the least in some aspects of the tradition. Moses is distinguished from Ezekiel, because Moses saw things with the greatest possible clarity, whereas Ezekiel did not. So this is perhaps a different thrust and different approaches. So am trying, I suppose, to say in general is that I know that within the rabbinic tradition there are those who took strong exception to any literal reading of Mark Barker quotes, I think, think some of them, the Exodus vision of when they ate and drank and saw, etc., which the Targum, the most frequently used one, delicately sort of metaphorizes, which you won't approve. Indeed, it does, because that was a great example of undue familiarity. They ate and drank in the presence of in the presence of God, but that is for me how, in short, I would understand some of these traditions and dilemmas. The question of familiarity and the matter of reticence. How, in one's familiarity, if one is given the privilege of a vision of God, does one necessarily retain one's absolute self-abnegation and humility, that whatever one has been given, God is ultimately and utterly, one has not grasped God, one has had the privilege of a spiritual vision, one has seen a little of the light, but no more than that. And so this is perhaps a slightly different perception, and so be it. Now, having read all of that, if I had longer, I would introduce you to two books essentially. One is a Christian book by William P. Brown called Seeing the Psalms, which is a very, very fascinating and poetic and deeply well-informed study of the images of Psalms and the notion of the word and what the word is and light, and very, very remarkable, because he's also well aware of archaeology, where people are coming from, what is being transformed and translated. So I do recommend that if one is looking at the languages of Psalms. But the second and very, very fascinating book is by a scholar whose name is Elliot Wolfson. Now, Wolfson is one of the most distinguished Judaic scholars, a Jewish scholar, which he is today, of the Kabbalistic and esoteric tradition. And he has several chapters on precisely what Dr. Barker was sharing with us from his perspective, which you might be interested in seeing what he has to say. He's done a great deal of reading on precisely these matters in the rabbinic literature, and what they make of it. But the part that fascinated me in particular, which I was going to conclude with, was briefly, if you're interested, it's around page 58 of the book, when he's talking about something utterly different, which is a phenomenology of Western mysticism, the language of Western mysticism. And I'm entirely dependent on him, on his reading for this, which is considerable. And he basically talks of two strands which stand out for him. One is the mysticism that uses no image at all, a sort of Neoplatonic mysticism, if you like, which forswears images. And the second is a mysticism that is the opposite, when God is precisely manifest to the person in the form of an image or a vision. Now, he has a great deal to say about this, but I thought it was very, very fascinating. It's not quite the same, but it's very similar to the dialogue of the this apparent dialogue or conflict of the Deuteronomists and the more visual, is precisely a phenomenon that one finds in the history of mysticism, which seems to me to be very remarkable indeed. Those who see images and those who do not are not only Deuteronomists and anti-Deuteronomists, if you like. This is a spiritual phenomenon, and that it seems to me to be not entirely, say, invalid when we approach the differences in the Bible, the biblical images, which you've spoken about so well, to also to think about it in terms of the mystical tradition, because I must say I found this this was I knew I read this only in preparation for tonight, and I was very struck by this quite extraordinary matter, that what we have in the discussions or debates of the Deuteronomy and Exodus is in fact a phenomenon that would be familiar to those who study the phenomenon, these matters in the Western mystical tradition. And one can't obviously make great leaps to say, well, the Deuteronomy people were one, and the other, etc., etc. But nevertheless, it is very remarkable. I mean, it is very profound, and that the two traditions, having to skip great chunks and reach a conclusion, do coexist in a lot of Jewish literature. It was thought for a very long time that the Targums were massively anti-anthropomorphic, and indeed some of them are. That is, that they very carefully remove, and some do, but there was a very interesting book which started out as a PhD, I think, in the 1980s, a gentleman called Michael Klein, who wrote a PhD on anthropomorphism in the Targums, and basically he strongly challenged the view that the Targums were non-anthropomorphic. They were both, effectively. People have been very struck by the anti-anthropomorphic parts, those that will have nothing to do with describing God in human form. But there are other elements which seem to coexist quite peaceably when they do describe God in human form. And so whether there is within the tradition, the notion even that the idea of the word is a denial of image and visibility is not necessarily quite so. The word is associated with light. The word is associated with the visual, very beautifully in some later Jewish tradition. The word is not simply a sort of puritanical approach to image. Mm. On the contrary, the word in itself is a source of an experience, of an inner experience that can be expressed only in notions of the visual. It was thought for a very long time, and including by me, incidentally, which shows the triumph of the Deuteronomists and Maimonides, that Judaism had no sort of visual side to its understanding of God at all. That ain't true. It's definitely not so. And even the Deuteronomic account has been interpreted, perhaps unduly, with an undue rigidity, which in the traditional sources is not quite so. So what I try to say briefly is the notion of reticence, so how that notion is preserved if we indeed have a profound sense of God, that at the same time the tradition calls upon, at least me, or as I understand it, not to be carried away by whatever little we have been privileged to see. That familiarity, undue familiarity, is not called for. That, if you like, the small hill in Jerusalem has always to remain a mountain. That is very difficult to climb. And that this seems to speak, and at least it's very unwise to say, well, the rabbinic tradition says this and that, because usually it's a vast tradition. And speakers are, the likes of me, are most ill-advised to say that, well, the Targums hold this or the rabbis hold that, because usually they're very diverse. But that these themes do seem to me to be of interest. And I thought it would be of interest to you also to hear Rabbeinu Bachya and his account of the burning bush, which I draw to a close. Thank you very much.